All right. So if you were, if you noticed the question Estelle thought, asked today and thought, that's not usually like one of Estelle's normal questions. Normally it's about like something going on in culture or, you know, like something, a better question than that. Why did we ask that question? It's because I told her to ask that question tonight because it gives me an excuse to tell you about the first car that I had. So you had to endure all of that just so I could tell you about this. I know, so it has a point, so just hold on with me. I know for some people, you know, the car that you drive is like purely a mode of transportation, just supposed to get you around from one place to another. But for some people, a car is like part of them, right? It's like a part of their identity. For me, when I was in high school, there was no way that my car could be part of my identity because I would have had to have seriously changed my identity if that was the case. But this this is the first car that I ever drove. So this is a Ford Crown Victoria. Not so bad. It's a grandma car. Actually, was my grandma's car. So, you know, big old boat of a car. All of the cop cars used to be Crown Vics. So whenever I would drive by people on the highway, they would slow down. And I was an unmarked police car. So that was the perk of that car. But then later on in high school, I got upgraded to this. This was a 1997 Dodge Caravan. And let me tell you, that was the car to drive when you were in high school. I could fit a lot of my friends in this car. It made me very popular. And I had a hula doll on the dashboard, which just adds to it. So these were my cars in high school. And then during college, I didn't have a car, but Lindsay did. We started dating in college.
So is that your actual car?
No, that's not my actual
car. Those are Nissan Maxima wheels.
That wasn't actually my car, but it looked just like it, so thanks for guessing that. So this was Lindsay's car in college, which then we kept when we got married. So I drove around this car for the first couple years we were married. This is also a grandma car, but it's like a more luxurious grandma. No, it's like your rich grandma who drives this car. So I drove this around for a couple years. We both did. And then we, after being married for a couple years, we needed another car. So I started researching what kind of car should I get. And I don't know if you guys are like this, if anyone does this with cars or something else, but I was not going to buy a car until I knew exactly what kind of car I want, like everything I could know about it. Not because I'm really into cars, but just because if I'm going to spend the money, like I want to make sure I do this right. So I do all this research online, weeks and weeks. I'm looking at, you know, all sorts of different magazines and how they're rating the cars and what's the mileage and reliability and safety and all this different stuff, trying to figure out like what's the right kind of car for me. Hours and hours and hours I pour into this. I end up getting this car. So this is a Mazda 3 hatchback. And I really enjoy this car. Driven for 3 years now. It's nothing flashy, but it gets me around and I like it. But what I realized a couple weeks, in the weeks and months following the purchase of this car, that I had basically wasted a lot of time. All this research, I had done hours and hours and hours of research on what kind of car to get. And this is the car I ended up finding, like this is the car I want. Like it's got everything that I want in a car. It's not the best car ever, but it's got everything that I want in a car. And then I started looking online at all these websites, trying to find it, finally found one that was like an hour away, drove down, was trying to negotiate a price, they said no, so I left. Came back the next week, and I was like, how about now? And they were like, no. So I said, fine, I'll just buy it anyway. But I put all this time into it, and a couple weeks and a couple months later, it was like, it's a great car, but there's a lot of cars that would have worked. There's a lot of cars that would do exactly what this car does. And what I realized is that I had lost perspective a little bit. Right? I had spent so much time researching, so much time thinking, like, what exactly would be the perfect kind of car for me, weighing the pros and cons, that I had lost perspective. I had put too much into this. And this was, in this case, the stakes were pretty low, like the kind of car I was driving around, not really a big deal. But there's a lot of other situations in life where we're trying to make decisions, right? Decisions that are a lot bigger than what kind of car are we going to drive. Decisions that cause a lot of stress and anxiety in our lives. And especially as young adults, we're in a stage of life where a lot of the decisions that we make have impacts that stretch out far into our lives sometimes, depending on what these decisions are. The kind of school we're going to go to, the kind of jobs that we're going to get, who are we going to date, who are we going to marry, where are we going to live. All of these questions that we're asking, all these decisions that we're making, they're decisions that carry some weight, that they impact the rest of our lives. And just like when I was trying to figure out what kind of car I was going to get, I was spending all this time researching, all this time thinking about it, I got too close to the issue that I lost perspective, right? I stopped seeing like what was really important, and I got fixated on so many of these details that I was convinced like this was the only car that could make me happy. And it was a Mazda 3. Like, it wasn't a BMW, it wasn't a Mercedes, it was a Mazda, but I was like, this is the car that I have to have. And sometimes when we're trying to make these decisions, we get so up close to them that we lose perspective. We forget about some other things that are important. And we lose our ability to make good decisions in some of these critical points. The passage that we're going to look at tonight, it's the next section in Philippians. Paul is making a decision. He's making a decision that's really important. It's actually a decision of life and death. Most of the decisions we make aren't decisions of life and death. This is actually a decision of life and death. And we get to sort of watch Paul think about this decision and sort of listen in on the conversation that he's having in his head. And when we do, we realize that Paul takes a particular perspective when he's trying to make this decision. And if we can learn from his perspective, if we can look at his perspective and understand it and learn from it, there's things that we can apply to all of the various decisions that we make in our lives by adopting the same kind of perspective that Paul has. So that's what we want to do tonight. We want to look at the next passage in Philippians, at this decision that Paul is making, and think about what are some implications for how we go about making both significant and insignificant decisions in our life. But first, a little bit more background on sort of where Paul's at and what this decision is. So we're in the book of Philippians. We've talked about the last couple weeks how Paul is writing this from prison in Rome. He's in this prison cell, and he's writing back to the Philippians, who he knows. He's visited Philippi. He's writing them, and we see this this sense of joy that sort of pervades the letter. But what we haven't said so much is, what is Paul doing in prison? We actually know quite a bit about how Paul got into prison, how he got into prison in Rome. The whole story is laid out in Acts. Paul, in Acts 21, he gets arrested by the Jews for preaching Christ and for doing what they thought was breaking their law, and it sort of starts this riot. And the Romans come in because they don't want unrest, they don't want riots, and they arrest Paul just to sort of stop this thing, and now they have to try him. And they're not, the Romans, they're not concerned. This is all happening in Jerusalem. The Romans aren't concerned about whether or not Paul broke a Jewish law. They don't care about that. They're trying to figure out, has Paul broken any Roman law? And there's two possible laws that he might have broken that they're sort of concerned about. One is that he could have been following an unauthorized religion. So there were certain religions in Rome. If you were going to have a religion, which everyone did, it had to be a religion that was approved by the state. Judaism was approved by the state. So the question was, is Christianity a sect of Judaism? Is it part of Judaism? Or is it something else? Is it another religion? Because if it's another religion, then that wouldn't be allowed, because this hasn't been approved by the Roman government. So that's one possible thing that they could be trying him for, that they're trying to figure out. But the more significant crime that Paul might have been guilty of, that he's on trial for, is basically treason. Paul went around preaching that Jesus Christ is the Lord in an empire where Caesar was the Lord. So the question is, has Paul's allegiance to Jesus made him an enemy of the state of Rome? Are those two things incompatible? Is he guilty of treason? So Paul's sitting in this prison cell while this trial is happening. He's waiting for a verdict to be reached. And most likely in either case, whichever crime he's convicted of, especially if it's treason, though, he would be executed. Hands down. No questions asked. If it was treason, he would have been executed. So he's sitting in prison. He's waiting for this verdict to be passed. And his life is in the balance. He's either going to be found innocent and he's going to be set free, or he's going to be found guilty and he's going to be put to death. So he sits there in this prison cell just waiting, and while he's waiting, he writes this letter. And in the passage that we look at today, we get to see Paul wrestle through, if I could pick the outcome of this trial, if I could pick the verdict, what would I pick? That's the decision. So it's not, he doesn't actually get to pick it. The decision's not actually his, but he walks through it as if this was his decision to make. And we can learn a lot about how he goes about that process for how we make decisions in our lives. So that's where we are in the story. Philippians 1, 18 to 26 is our passage. So you can turn there if you'd like to. And just as a way of reminder, we're picking up where we left off in the story last time, which is basically Paul has been asked the question, how are you? And he goes about responding, telling them about his current situation. But first, he addresses the gospel and he says, I am full of joy because the gospel is advancing. That was last week. Now he sort of continues and gives a more full response about his current situation. So we're going to start actually halfway through verse 18. Most of your translations probably break it, the paragraph in the middle of verse 18. So starting in the middle of verse 18, Paul says this. Yes, and I will continue to rejoice. So we had just seen he's rejoicing because the gospel is advancing, and he comes back and says, yes, and I will continue to rejoice, for I know that through your prayers and God's provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, what has happened to me will turn out for my deliverance. I eagerly expect and hope that I will in no way be ashamed, but will have sufficient courage so that now as always, Christ will be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, to live is Christ and to die is gain. If I'm to go on living in the body, this will mean fruitful labor for me. Yet which shall I choose? I do not know. I'm torn between the two. I desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. But it's more necessary for you that I remain in the body. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain, and I will continue with you, with all of you, for your progress and joy in the faith, so that through my being with you, again, your boasting in Christ Jesus will abound on account of me. So we can see in there Paul wrestling with this decision. If I could pick, what would I pick? What do I hope happens in this situation? And if we put ourselves in Paul's position for a minute, we might think that the choice is obvious. Right? The two outcomes of the trial are either life and freedom or death. So we might say, well, obviously you're going to choose life and freedom in that situation. Why would you not? Right? Especially as Americans, like, we're all about freedom, right? Why would you not want your freedom? And what we're going to find out is that actually that is the decision that Paul ends up going with, but for very different reasons than we might think, or very different reasons that we might make. So let's walk through this passage and look in a little more detail about how Paul comes to his decision. So he starts off and he says in verse 18 again, yes, and I will continue to rejoice. And then he's going to tell us why. Why is he rejoicing? Why is it that he can sit in this prison cell and be happy and rejoice? He says, for I know that through your prayers and God's provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, what happened to me will turn out for my deliverance. So Paul is convinced that because of the prayers of the Philippians and the Holy Spirit, he's going to be delivered. And so we might think, oh, well, he knows what the outcome of the trial is going to be. He knows he's going to be delivered. But what we find in the next verse, at the end of verse 20, we see he says that Christ will be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. So Paul says he's going to be delivered. He's confident that he's going to be delivered, and yet he doesn't know if he's going to live or die. Well, how can that be? It's because for Paul, deliverance is not about whether he lives or dies. Right? Deliverance is not about whether he's found guilty or innocent. Deliverance for Paul, in this case, deliverance, that word for deliverance, it also means salvation or vindication. So deliverance for Paul, vindication for Paul, is that the gospel wins, that Christ is exalted in his body, which he says that can happen if I live or if I die. Right? He doesn't tell us which way he's leaning. He just says, yeah, I can be killed, and in my death, Christ can be exalted in my body. Or I can be set free and I can live, and in my life, Christ will be exalted in my body. I'm going to get back out on the streets. I'm going to keep preaching. I'm going to keep planting churches. I'm going to keep loving people. Right? Either way, if I live or if I die, I'm going to be vindicated. The gospel is going to win. Jesus Christ is going to be exalted in my body. And then he continues. And what comes next is one of the most well-known phrases that Paul has in all the New Testament. He says, "For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain." To live is Christ, and to die is gain. So Paul is sitting in prison. He's trying to figure out, what does he want to happen? What's the ideal outcome? And like many of us do, as he's trying to make a decision, he starts to make a list of pros and cons, right? What are the pros and cons to either a guilty verdict or an innocent verdict? And he makes a statement, "For me, to live is Christ and to die is gain." So he says, well, let's consider what happens if I live. Well, if I live, I'm going to get back out on the street. I'm going to be preaching again. People are going to see that God delivered me. God is going to be glorified. Jesus is going to be glorified. For me, to live is Christ. My life is about Christ. Everything I do is about Christ. And if I live, it's going to continue to be about Christ. It's a pro to living. Okay, what about dying? Pros and cons to dying. Well, we might think a con to a guilty verdict is death. We might put that in the con call. But Paul goes, for me, to die is gain. To die is to gain Christ. Paul says, if I live, my life is for Christ. If I die, I get to be with Christ. So the outcome of a guilty verdict is also a pro, right? It's also a pro. It's a good thing. If I live, it's a great thing. If I die, it's even better. He says, it's even better if I die. And this is where we should be struck by what Paul says. Because I think if we were making this decision, we would probably say, well, living is a good thing and dying is a bad thing. So I want to live. But Paul actually says, living, it's a good thing. Dying, that's a better thing. Because I get to go be with Jesus, this person that I've devoted my life to, this person who knocked me down on the Damascus Road and who changed my life and who's done so many things for me. If I get to go be with this person, that's a good thing. That's gain. But yet he doesn't go with that decision. We read on in verse 22 as he's thinking about this, he says, "For if I am to go on living in the body, this will mean fruitful labor for me. Yet which shall I choose? I do not know. I'm torn between the two. I desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better." He recognizes that that's the best case scenario for me, to die and to be with Christ. "But it's more necessary for you that I remain in the body. So, convinced of this, I know that I will remain." Convinced of this. Convinced that it's better for you that I stay alive. If I could make this decision, that's what I would pick. If I could determine the outcome of this trial, I would be found innocent. Not because I want my freedom, not because I want to live, but because it's more necessary for your sake that I live. Isn't that amazing how Paul makes that decision? In such a different way than I think we would. We would be like, of course we want to live. Of course we want to live. No, we don't want to die. And then if we follow Paul's logic and we go, oh, you know what? It actually is better to die because we get to be with Jesus. Then I think we'd probably swing over and go, okay, well, then I want to die. Then if that's what's better, if that's what's best, then that's what I want to happen. But then Paul swings back over and says, no, but it's better for you that I stay alive. So I hope, I'm convinced of this. I'm convinced that I will remain. If I can make this decision, I would stay. And there's even a sense where we feel like Paul thinks that that's what's going to happen. Right? There's a sense that Paul thinks he's going to make it out of prison. So that, why does he want to stay? He wants to stay with all of you for your progress and joy in the faith. Right? So he recognizes that he has something that the Philippians need. And he doesn't have to be the one who gives it to them, but they need someone to come alongside them and to help them in their progress and joy in the faith. Someone who can come alongside them and teach them, what does it mean to follow Jesus? Right? What does it mean to grow in your relationship with him? What does it mean to find your joy in Jesus? They need someone to do this. Paul says, that's me right now. I'm the one who needs to do that. So I hope that that's what happens for their progress and joy in the faith. And so that through my being with you, so that my going back to you, Philippians, your boasting in Christ will abound on account of me. So he says, yes, I want to go back for you. I want to stay alive for your sake, but not just for your sake. I want to survive this so I can go and help you so that you can glorify God, so that you can boast about him, so that you can look at my life, see how God freed me from prison, how I've come to you, how I've given up whatever else I could have to be with you, and that you would boast about God because of what I've done. That's Paul's heart in this decision. He thinks it's better to die than to be with Christ, and yet he chooses to stay for the good of the Philippians and for the glory of God. So what does that have to do with our lives? What does that have to do with the way that we make decisions? I mean, we don't find ourselves, I think most of the time, maybe never, in these life and death situations where we're trying to decide, is it better to live or to die? Or even situations, the number of situations we find ourselves in where we're trying to just avoid death and figure out the best way to do that, they're pretty rare. We don't find ourselves in these life and death situations, but we do find ourselves in lots of situations where we have to make important decisions. Something has to be done, and we have to decide, do I go left or do I go right? So what can we learn from this passage, from the way that Paul wrestles through this issue about how we can think about some of these issues, some of these decisions that we face? There's probably lots of ways, but I want to suggest three things that we can learn from this. The first thing that we want to keep in mind when we're trying to make these decisions in our lives is that our relationship with Jesus should impact every other decision that we make. Our relationship with Jesus should impact every other decision that we make. There's no area of our lives, there's no sphere of our lives that should go untouched by the fact that we follow Jesus. No area of our life should be the same because of what Jesus has done for us, because of what Jesus has done in us. So does that mean that if I get up in the morning and I'm trying to decide between Fruit Loops and Frosted Flakes, that there's a right and a wrong answer, right? That my relationship with Jesus should affect that? Well, I don't think Jesus cares if I have Frosted Flakes or Fruit Loops. I'm pretty sure he doesn't, actually. There's probably a lot of decisions that I make that he doesn't care which way I choose. But I think that that decision should still be affected by my relationship with Jesus, because if he were to ask me to make a decision in that situation, if he were to ask me to give up Frosted Flakes, I should be willing to give up Frosted Flakes, right? Not because there's any good reason. There's probably lots of good reasons to give up Frosted Flakes. But even if there were no good reasons, just the fact that he wanted me to do it should be reason enough. So in that sense, every decision that we make should be affected by our relationship with Jesus. Right? Not because he's determining every little thing that we do, but because we should be willing to yield control to all of those decisions to him, big or small, important or insignificant. Second thing that we can learn from this is that Jesus is the ultimate source of joy. Jesus is the ultimate source of joy. When we go about making decisions in our lives, choosing between A or B, left or right, most of the time, there's some element of seeking after joy. We want to do what makes us happy. Are you going to take this job or not? Well, what's going to be better for me, right? Are you going to buy this car or not? Well, does it have everything I need? Is this the car that's going to make me the most happy? Is it going to do the most work for me? Is this the thing that's going to do it? Well, a car, it's a pretty bad investment. Like, you know, it's just going to decrease in value really quick. So maybe what would be better for me is to buy a really inexpensive car and then invest this money, because that's what's going to make me happier. That's what's going to bring me the joy. How do I use my money? All of these decisions that we make, there's some element of seeking after joy. And if we miss the fact that Jesus is the ultimate source of joy, then we miss everything. Because if we're seeking after joy in the decisions that we make, which is a good thing to do, right? We should be seeking after joy. God made us to seek after joy. We should do that. But if we don't recognize that Jesus is the ultimate source of joy, then we miss the whole thing. And the decisions that we make aren't actually going to result in what we're hoping that they will. So if we remember that Jesus is the ultimate source of joy, then that's able to help us as we make all these other decisions in our lives, because we recognize that ultimately he's the answer. And now, how do these other things fit into that? Right? How do these decisions fit in to Jesus? Third thing, one last thing that I think we can learn from this passage is that our choices, the decisions that we make, are meant to lead other people to boast in God. The decisions that we make are meant to lead other people to boast about God. We've been put here not just for ourselves, right? Paul doesn't choose to stay for himself, and he doesn't choose even just to stay for the Philippians. He chooses to stay so that the Philippians would boast in God. We should be living our lives in a way, we should be making decisions in a way that are attractive to people, that people see this amazing change that's taken place in our lives, that people see a level of character, a level of love that's not possible outside of Christ, that they should see us taking risks that don't make any sense from a worldly perspective because of Jesus, and that would cause them to boast about God. Wow, look at what God has done in this person's life. Wow, look at what God did for this person when they prayed, when they asked him. Wow, isn't that God amazing? As we make our decisions, we should be thinking about how can our decisions help other people to boast in God. Well, last week I ended my talk by talking about Francis Chan. I'm going to do the same thing this week, because why not? Francis Chan was actually at Google this last week. He gave a talk called How to Get to Heaven from Silicon Valley. Interesting. And he was talking about a lot of different things, but Lindsay and I went with Kristen, and we were able to hear him. And one of the things that he said I thought was really helpful. He was trying to bring to light the fact that where we live, here specifically in Silicon Valley, it's a really hard place to make decisions. It's a really hard place to make decisions because there are a lot of factors around us that are encouraging us to make bad decisions, right? That make us lose our perspective. We see all these people around us that are seeking after the next big thing, money, fame, significance, family, whatever. They're seeking after all of these things, and those voices are really loud around us, and they influence the way that we make decisions, and they cause us to lose perspective. So what Francis said he has to do on a regular basis is get out of the U.S. And he goes to countries that are super poor and there's a lot of need, because he finds that when he's in those places, he's able to make better decisions. And I've found this to be the case as well. When I've been on mission trips in the past, it's a lot easier to think about giving up your Starbucks every day if it means that this kid that you're sitting next to gets to eat lunch and dinner. Right? That's a good decision. It's a good decision to give up your Starbucks so that a kid can eat. But it's hard to make that decision here sometimes. It's easy to make it if we go there, because we gain some perspective. I think we need to gain perspective. It doesn't mean that we have to necessarily get out of the country and go to some place where there's a lot of poverty and need. Maybe that's what it takes for us. But I think that we have to gain perspective. I think that we have to step back a little bit. I think that we have to immerse ourselves in this, and we've got to be praying a lot so that we know God, so that we know the things that are in His heart, so that all of these voices that are speaking at us from our culture don't get louder than this voice. We need to gain perspective. We need to spend time with God. We need to spend time in His Word. We need to be out loving and serving people and seeing the need that's around. And when we do, I think we'll find, like Paul did, that God is glorified. That people start to boast about God because they see us, they watch us, they look at the decisions that we make, and they go, those are weird decisions, right? They don't make any sense apart from Christ, apart from God and what He's done for us, and wanting to be faithful and obedient to Him. So I'm going to pray that God would do that. I'm going to pray that God would help to give us perspective so that His voice would be louder than all these other voices around us. Let's pray. Lord, I thank You that You have spoken to us. Lord, I thank You that You speak to us through Your Word, that You speak to us through Your Spirit who lives in us. And Lord, I pray that as we go about trying to make all the various decisions that we have to make in a given day, in a week, a month, a year, some insignificant, some significant, I pray that we could just lay all of these decisions down before You. And I pray that when we do, we would find that we've gained some perspective, that it's easier to follow You, that it's easier to recognize that You are our true and only source of joy, and that others would come to boast about You because of the way that You work in through us. I know, Lord, that there's a lot of complicated decisions. Even in this room, there's a lot of complicated decisions that need to be made. It's hard to know what to do in any given situation. I pray that You'd give us wisdom. I pray that You would help us to make decisions that are honoring and glorifying to You. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.